Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. In this extra episode, I'm talking to Diane Sherman about her near-death experience. Diane is a spiritual life coach, intuitive counselor, and vibrational healer, and certified mediator, and she has clients all over the world. In 1981, she had a near-death experience during a simple, common arthroscopic knee operation. She came back with psychic abilities of clairaudience, clairsentience, and clairvoyance. For the last 30 years, Diane has worked as a spiritual coach. Hi, Diane. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. It's lovely to be with you.
So today we're going to talk about your near-death experience and how it affected your life. But first of all, could you tell us, how did it come about?
Well, I had gone into the hospital for arthroscopic surgery on my left knee. And, you know, it's a longer story than that. I had had an accident in Mexico with my husband 10 years before when we were swimming. And there was great undertow, and I was trying to climb out of the water because I was getting really tired. And my husband had played water polo for years in Italy. So, you know, he was a strong swimmer and he was fine. And as I'm climbing out of the water and the beach had an incline, my left foot went into the sand. A wave hit me from behind and pulled me back down into the water. And I totally twisted my leg, of course, in that position. And it turned out that I had dislocated it and done all kinds of damage to it. And luckily for me, my husband being a strong swimmer, he pulled me up out of the water because I was absolutely clung onto my knee. I couldn't stop yelping and holding onto my knee. I couldn't, you know, tread water and do any of those things. And so he grabbed me up and our dear friends took me to their chiropractor, who didn't speak a word of English. And my Spanish was very minimal at that point. And he had me on this, it looked like a daybed. It had rungs behind my head. And he pointed to me to hold on to the rungs, which I did. And he grabbed my foot and leg up into the air and he twisted. And when he did that, the pain was so excruciating, I passed out. And I've got a strong threshold for pain. Anyway, he did even more damage. By the time I got x-rayed, I had a blood clot. I had chip bone fragments. I had all kinds of things besides a dislocated knee. He had done some major damage to my patella with that movement.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, because I was modeling, that was my work, my career, I could not withstand having an open patella surgery. It would have been a huge scar down the middle of my knee. So I opted to not do that. And I waited 10 years until the arthroscopic surgery process was really perfected and normal and all of that. And that's when I had it. So that morning when I went into the hospital, I was sitting on a gurney outside of the operating suite. And I was just racking with cold, and I hadn't had any medication yet. And, of course, I hadn't had breakfast or anything else because, you know, you have to have an empty stomach and whatnot. And I'm laying on this gurney, and one of the nurses came up to me, and she said, "Would you like a heated blanket?" And I said, "Oh, my gosh, I'd love that. I didn't know that you could do that, but I'd love to have that." So she brought that to me, and that seemed to calm my body down greatly. And at that point, I went into the surgical suite and they put another blanket on me and a pre-op shot. And I was out like light. I didn't even, you know, wait till the anesthesia to go out. So that was kind of an interesting aside for my body to do that. And I guess the surgery turned out to be almost 2 hours longer than it was originally planned to be, because at that time in 1981, they didn't have MRIs. They couldn't see how much damage was in there past, you know, having the x-ray. And when they got in there, I guess they had a lot of rearranging and fixing to do. And so I was on the table and under anesthesia much longer than had anticipated. And at that time in my life, because I was a working model, I was really thin. And the surgery went fine. They did everything they needed to do. And I ended up in recovery. And as I'm awakening in recovery, I'm hearing noise in the bed next to me. And I'm thinking, I don't really want to pay attention to what's going on with somebody else. You know, I'm in my own world here. And I hear them saying, Diane, wake up. Diane, wake up. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, what are the circumstances that she would have the same name as me? And then I went back to my own experience and sort of tuned that out. And a few minutes later, I hear them saying, Diane Sherman, wake up. Diane Sherman, wake up. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, they've got the wrong person. That's me. And I'm waving my hand to them and I'm saying, hey, that's me. And I'm here and I'm fine. And they're not paying any attention to me, Simon. There's no connection to me whatsoever. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's because they're so busy trying to save this person's life. So we'll just let that pass. And, you know, when a nurse comes over, I'll have a conversation and, you know, see what's going on for me. And the next thing I knew, I was standing at the bottom of that bed, that bed that she was in, that they're working on her. And I'm looking up at her as I'm standing at the bottom of her bed, and I see that it's me. And I look down on me standing there, and I can see myself in the hospital gown, and all parts are there. And I'm looking up, and there's me again. And I'm thinking, isn't that odd? Which at the moment was a really odd reaction to it. I mean, I didn't have any fear, or I didn't have any connection to the woman that was in the bed in front of me that they were trying to resuscitate. And I'm sort of notating what's going on, but I'm not having any connection to anything. And the next thing I know, I'm floating up and I'm in the corner of the ceiling, now looking down over everything that they're doing for her. And again, I'm just notating this. I'm not really invested in it, which is, you know, pretty odd. And from there, I'm feeling like I'm being extricated out of the room. So I'm being pulled out of that corner of the ceiling of the room. And the next sensation is I'm being hurled forward. And every time I talk about that, I can feel my back arch in trying to not go forward. But I'm going forward and it's just blackness. Everything is blackness. And as a kid, I was terrified of the dark. And having this experience of being in the blackness, there were two things as a kid, you know, terrified of what was going to happen in the dark and terrified of being blind in the dark and being that vulnerable. So all of that is happening now as I'm being hurled forward into this blackness. And I'm thinking, okay, if I could just find a little glimmer of light, some little spark of light, I'll know, number one, I'm not blind, and number two, that I'm safe. And that there's a way to go, you know, to get out or do whatever I need to do. And so I'm stretching myself to just hold on to this glimmer of light. And as I'm holding on to it and feeling it and watching it, and all of my hopes and dreams are on it right now, you know, I'm just, it's getting bigger and it's coming closer and it's growing. And I'm now kind of mesmerized by it. And it is now becoming this white light that's all around me. It's everywhere. It's all I can see. And it's this beautiful color of white I have never, ever seen before. It's illumination. It's got all the colors of the rainbow in it. And It's got this consistency, this, it's almost like clouds, but not clouds. And it's diaphanous, and it's, I don't know if ephemeral is the right word, but it's just this magnificent energy of something that is so foreign to me, but so loving to me. And my body is calming down. And as I'm moving forward with it, in it, and it's all around me, I'm now seeing that it's starting to part in front as I'm, what I would say, floating through it. And I remember at the time saying to myself, I'm floating, because I'm looking down and I'm seeing, I'm like 2 feet off the ground. I'm not way up high, but I am floating. And I thought that was odd and interesting and kind of funny at the moment, to recognize that I was floating. And as I get to the end of the white where it's parted open, there are two rows of monks, and they're in brown robes with their hoods up, and there's six on either side. And I get to the end of them, and the one on the end on the left steps forward, and he, I always say he because it felt masculine and all the wonderful ways of masculinity, he said to me, "You cannot stay. It's not your time." And I looked at him and I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You cannot stay. It's not your time. You must go back." And in that moment, I realized that I was feeling this unconditional love that I had never experienced in my life. I was feeling cherished. I was feeling like I mattered, that everything about me was important, that I had come home to myself and come home to God. It was everything I had ever wanted in my life. And in that moment, he repeated, "You cannot stay. You must go back. You have a child." And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I've got my daughter, Christina, who's six. Who could take care of her? I wanted to stay. Who could take care of her? Her father and I were divorced for a reason. My parents were both dead. My sister was not emotionally equipped to take care of my daughter. And I'm thinking, who would love her the way I want her to be loved and cared for? And in that moment, I'm back in my body.
So it was a sudden jump back into your body.
Yep.
Do you feel that you were pushed or you made the decision to go back?
I wish I could tell you my truth, because I don't know. I have a sense that I went back because of my daughter, but I don't know for sure. I mean, I've heard other NDEers talk about, you know, how divine it is and how they didn't want to leave. I loved my daughter more than anything in the world, and I would do I'd walk through fire for her. But in that moment, Simon, I did not want to come back in my body. I had never experienced anything so blissful in my life. And to give that up was almost more overwhelming than anything I'd ever experienced. So I don't know what the answer was, and I won't know until I'm back on the other side.
So how did your body feel? I've heard near-death experiences, a couple of them say that when they came back and they saw their body, they thought, how am I going to fit in there? I'm so huge. That body's so small. Was it a nasty shock to come back, or not so bad?
I didn't see my body. I just slammed into it. And it's like being in a very tight rubber glove. That's all I can experience, reference. It was tight and it was uncomfortable. And every pain or ache or every fear, every concern, everything that felt shameful or guilty or, you know, all the bad stuff, it all came flying in at the same time. It was such a shock to my senses on all levels. I can't even imagine, you know, how we get through that. We do, but yeah.
Did the nurse that was trying to wake you, did she realise that perhaps something really bad was happening? Because if you had this experience, they say it's like near death. Or did she not see that perhaps your heart had stopped or anything and she was just still trying to wake you?
Well, when I awakened, I was back in my hospital room. I wasn't in recovery. I was out of recovery. All of my episode happened in the recovery. So I don't know what she or whoever it was that awakened me saw. I have no idea. And in 1981, they weren't talking about it.
Because I was going to ask you that, because you had that time where you were out of body and you could see what the nurse was doing and you were up at the ceiling. I was going to ask, did you talk to any of the medical staff about what you saw, and they confirmed that what happened?
No, because I had no idea what had happened. You know, who talked about near death in 1981? Raymond Moody's book had only been out, what, a year or two? I had no idea about near death. I had no idea what had happened to me.
When you were standing at the bed watching what was happening, did
yes.
you notice anything about what your body was like there? Because I've talked to NDEs who say that while they were in the experience, it seemed like their body was much younger. And one of them said they looked down at their hands and there's no scar there. And they're thinking, they look like my hands when I was 18.
Well, I was in my early 30s when this happened. So did I notice that? No. What I noticed when I looked down at myself is that I was fully present. I mean, I was fully in a body. I didn't look like spirit in any way. I could feel myself. You know, it was like I had all of the normal experience of my body just looking down at it. But I also saw the other version of me that was in the bed that they were trying to resuscitate, which I thought, I would have thought, you know, that I would have gotten anxious or concerned or at least involved in that. And it was like somebody said, pass the salt. I couldn't have cared less. I was not that person in the bed.
It's weird, isn't it? Because
it
seems
is.
Like such an emotional thing to go through, a near-death experience. And you'd think there'd be a lot of emotion connected with that.
Well, but we're at that point, I was in spirit more than I was in physical.
Yeah.
And, you know, spirit doesn't have that emotional range. We have that as human beings. It's why we come in, is to have feelings and emotions. So I understand why I didn't have it at that moment.
So when you were standing at the foot of the bed, were you wearing the hospital gown in spirit?
Yes.
It's fascinating how that came together. Because the spirit might not be at all physical. You might be just a
exactly.
ball of light or something. So where did that come from? Maybe out of your subconscious or something?
I don't know. I don't know how it all operates. You know, you hear NDEers talk about, you know, being in beautiful countrysides, walking through the greenery and the flowers. And all. I mean, I don't know. I know that the monks were a good representation for me of my Catholic upbringing. You know, the monks were the safest part of the Catholic Church, as far as I was concerned, much more so than the priests. And that part was analogous. Some of this other, I don't know. You know, when I went to the area in this, it was like a hall, you know, an ancient building with beautiful carvings and ceiling paintings and all that kind of stuff. And where these monks were. And it felt like they were some kind of tribunal in a way, you know, some kind of group that was helping to guide me to the next level of myself. And, you know, I didn't see family or anything, no loved ones, just these monks.
Did you see their faces or were their hoods right down?
No, the hoods were up on where their heads would be, but there were no faces. It was a blackness, and it kind of looked like, oh, you've seen it in science fiction movies and stuff where they've got atoms and whatnot moving back and forth, and it's kind of like a little bit of bright light, you know, flashing back and forth. And that's what their faces looked like. And the only face that I saw was the one that stepped forward and spoke to me. I didn't see faces on any of the others. It was just blackness.
And the one that stepped forward, was he looked like a kindly old man, or was he a lot younger?
He was younger than an old man. Kindly, yes. In charge, assertive. I felt safe with him. I felt that he knew what he was doing, even though I didn't know what I was doing. And so I was grateful for that feeling that he was sort of in charge and guiding me. And I could feel his concern for me.
And did you feel that you've met him before? Like there was some real strong familiarity?
None. Absolutely none. No. But in that energy, you know, coming through the white light and being with the monks, there was this energy of just unconditional love. I felt cherished for the first time in my life. And I don't know if it was emanating from the monks or the experience or the place we were in, or it was just the known energy of where we were, which is kind of what I felt. But it was so yummy.
And it was kind of tailored for you and your beliefs at the time being Catholic and your experience when you were younger with, I mean, what were the priests like or the nuns?
Well, the nuns, some of them could be quite lovely, but there were a few that were pretty mean. And, you know, they could hit your hands and do, you know, manner of stuff with big rulers or map pointers and whatnot. They could be pretty threatening. The priests, I never had a bad experience with a priest physically. They were just, I don't know, odd to me. They were different and odd and not in a comfortable way. You know, I didn't feel protected by them. I didn't feel connected to them, you know, especially during confession. You know, young kids going into confession, it was always scary. I don't know. The whole process of the church was not what it should be. And that was one of the things that I came away with, is that I left the church after my near-death experience because I realized that the church had taught me all about fear, control, shame. It was very disempowering. And being on the other side, it's only unconditional love. There is no judgment. And yet, you know, as kids, we went to Mass and Holy Communion, had to go to confession, and, you know, and you're loaded up with all these sins, you're told, and there's none of that on the other side. And that was shocking to me, but in a good way.
You didn't have a life review like some NDEs report.
No, I did not. I didn't have a lot of the things that other NDEs report.
I wonder if that's because you didn't need it.
I hope so.
It's like what you experienced was tailored just for you, so it would work just for you. That's why you saw monks. And so They didn't give you a life review because they felt, no, you're doing fine. We don't need to hit you with all that stuff.
Well, it's interesting because before I had my surgery, a week or so before I had my surgery, I had been to church and I had been praying fervently for guidance because I was kind of at a crossroads. I didn't know where I was going and what I was going to do with my life. I had a six-year-old little girl. I was divorced. My career was ending because at that time in your 30s, you know, you were already over the hill. And it was also, you know, I'd done it for 17 years. It was enough. I needed something other than that. And I was really afraid. And my parents were both dead, so I couldn't go to them to talk it out. And it was like I went to church and I said, you've got to guide me here, help me here. I am lost. And then, you know, then I had my near-death experience and that changed everything.
Yeah, that's interesting that you kind of asked for it in a way.
I did. Yeah. I begged and pleaded for it. I mean, I felt like a scene out of the nun story when I was at church, you know, being prostrate on the floor kind of thing. I was begging and pleading so hard. So I'm not surprised that I called it in. Didn't know I had that kind of, you know, connection or power, but I'm thrilled and delighted. It did change my life.
But I suppose you wouldn't do it again, given the opportunity.
If I got the opportunity to go home, period, I would not come back. I am so ready at almost 79 to go. I know how divine it is. I know how yummy it is.
So with the black void that you went into, what do you make of that? What could that be, like a representation of purgatory or something?
I don't believe in purgatory. I really don't see that as a truth. I think it could have been a transition from being alive to not being alive, you know, going through the tunnel.
Some people see the tunnel, but you didn't. It was just another form of transition.
Well, it probably was the tunnel. It's just all of my senses were focused on the blackness, because the tunnel is usually black.
So how was the healing of the wound after the operation?
Well, interestingly enough, the lady who I shared my hospital room with, she'd had arthroscopic surgery and was in abject pain. And she'd had very little compared to me done to her in surgery. And I wasn't on any pain medication at all. And they had me up walking that night. Now, today that would be the norm, but then it wasn't the norm. And my doctor said to me when I saw him in the office, he said, I've never seen anybody heal as fast as you did. He even showed me the video of the surgery so I could understand how much they had to do.
This is something we hear as well, isn't it? Other near-death experiences that I talked to one of them and they said that he got labeled the miracle boy. That's what all the medical staff called him because his healing was so good.
Sure. Well, you know, it makes sense. When you're in that energy, your vibration is so high, your body knows how to heal. It would naturally occur.
Yeah, I wonder if there's some kind of spiritual influence in there, or you brought something back.
Oh, sure. Oh, I'm sure there is. You know, the ball gets rolling there, and then it just continues as you come out. You know, look at Anita Morjani. I mean, she was at the very, very end of her life. All of her systems had shut down, and then it all turned around in an instant.
When you woke up in the hospital, did you remember the whole experience, or did it take time to come back to you?
I did not remember the whole experience. It took a long time to come back. I had no idea I'd had a near-death experience. First of all, I'm a lightweight when it comes to drugs of any kind, and the anesthesia was a lot for me to get over. And I didn't know until, well, I guess it was about a week later, I went out to dinner with my sister. I'm, you know, still hobbling on crutches, but we went to a restaurant we were familiar with and went to frequently. And we were waiting at the doorway to be seated. And all of a sudden, I got this overwhelming feeling. It was like a crescendo coming at me, or a big wave coming at me, of everybody's thoughts and feelings and story and pain and suffering and dialogue. And it was just, it was a cacophony of everything that room was emanating. And I was blown away by it. I didn't know what the heck was happening. I was just done in by all that I was feeling in my body and hearing and sensing and processing. And it was like, oh my God, am I losing my mind? Am I becoming psychotic? Because I'm hearing dialogue from more than one source. That's when I knew something had happened.
That must have been quite overwhelming. Was it something that you found you could control, or did it die down eventually?
I couldn't control it then. I learned to manage it. I learned to be in harmony with it. I learned to allow it when it was appropriate and in ways it was appropriate. So it was a big learning curve. I really thought I was losing my mind.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, and I hope you check it out. And is this something you do for people now, mediumship or psychic?
I don't really do mediumship. I do psychic work, clairsentient, clairaudient, and clairvoyant. And I think the most important thing that I do for people is that I see their preciousness. I see beyond the facade of who they are. I see behind the mask, and I feel and know them in that, and I show that back to them so that they can learn to love and appreciate their own preciousness and work with that and have a wonderful time being them. You know, for most of my life until I had my near death, I was very anxious and afraid. And I realized in that experience that I didn't have to be that way anymore. And I didn't want other people to be that way. I didn't want people to have to suffer being afraid of living their life for fear of death and living their life for fear of, you know, not being okay in the world. And so the work that I do is to help people shore themselves up and find a way that's appropriate for them and feels good for them and have a life that they're happy to have, a life worth living.
So do you have a website? Can people contact you and book a time with you?
Absolutely. My website is guidingyourspirit.com.
So do you think that what happened to you was like a life path that was planned before you were born?
I hope so. That would be really cool if it was.
Do you feel that you've come back with a mission?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I had been struggling trying to figure out what the mission was for most of my life. You know, I knew I was here to do something. I somehow thought it was through a husband because that's the generation I come from. I didn't realize it was something I was to do. And I'm so grateful that I figured it out and that I was guided and shown and supported to get here because I love what I do. And I'm very grateful that I have clients all over the world. I've never advertised, and somehow they all say the same thing. They're attracted to me, and it must be the spirit energy, you know, that's still with me that allows them to know that this is a safe place to come to. At least I hope that's what it is for them.
Was there a period of time, maybe years, where you remembered what the experience was? You didn't know what a near-death experience was. You didn't know there was a word for it or a phrase. And then you saw something and you thought, hang on, that's what happened to me.
Exactly. One of the things that I realized is that God, spirit, the universe, whatever you want to call it, is loving us so dearly. And I really didn't have the awareness of that to the extent that I do now. And I was literally guided to people who would guide me to processing and understanding what I had had as an experience. Each one of them had a different piece of the puzzle for me. And they introduced me to a world of spirituality that I didn't know, and metaphysics that I didn't know existed. And I became this, you know, spiritual junkie. I couldn't get enough information, awareness, people to play with, experiences to have. And I am so grateful for all of that. You know, I came to your country at one point and went through a sacred tours trip where we went to the various, oh my God, I've lost my vocabulary. We went to Stonehenge. We had permission to go into Stonehenge, which at that time was not allowed. And we played with the stones and we were there at sunset and it was very uplifting. And You felt like you could levitate off the ground. And then we went to the crop circle tour, is what I was trying to remember. We went on a crop circle tour for 10 days, and that was like being a child. I mean, I've never played so heartily in my life as we did in the crop circles. It was just, it was phenomenal. It was very heady. It made you feel like you were doing drugs and you weren't doing anything except sitting in nature and being in the vibration of it. And, you know, one of the interesting things about crop circles is they're laid down in a certain direction. And if you walk the opposite direction while you're in them, you feel like a salmon going upstream. You feel the pressure against your body. I mean, they're palpable. I don't know why people think that they're man-made. Is there anything but? So I got introduced to all kinds of things in my search of trying to figure out where I had been and what had occurred with me.
And have you been at IANS and taking part with them?
Oh, sure. For years. Yeah. That was the first place that I spoke. I had gone, somebody invited me to an IANS meeting. And this gentleman got up and he started to talk about his near-death experience. And all of a sudden, my body just started to vibrate. And I realized, oh my God, that's what I need to do. I need to talk about it. And that was in 2010, I think, something like that, 2010. That was the first time I spoke, I think, was 2010. When I did speak, there was a gentleman there who had a TV show in San Jose, California. And I was in Marin County, which is not far from there. And he asked me if he could, you know, come and do a video with me and put it on his show. And I thought, I don't know why this man wants to do this, but I'm okay with doing it. So we did it. And that was the beginning of it. And that one particular one got, well, I don't know, 400,000 hits on the internet. And that's when things were first coming out on the internet. And I didn't even know that they put videos on the internet. And it was like shocking to me. So it hasn't been that long that I've been openly talking about it.
Do you remember the experience today as if it happened yesterday?
Oh, I can feel it all in my body. As we're talking about it, I'm so in the moment of it. I may not remember what I had for breakfast, but boy, I know that one. It never leaves you. It brings you right back into the present of the moment.
Has it changed your view of mankind in a way?
Absolutely. I'll start with how it changed my view of myself. I, at that point, when I had gone to church and prayed for help and all of that stuff, I really felt kind of victimized by my life. And when I had my near-death experience, I realized that life was happening through me. It wasn't happening to me. I didn't know that concept before that. I didn't know that how I felt about myself, my perceptions about myself and my life and the people around me and the world around me, that informed everything that was coming my way. The vibration that I had at that moment in my perceptions created a vibration of people's interactions and attitudes and beliefs about me coming towards me. And when I realized that if I changed my focus, if I changed how I felt about me and others, that it would change how we interacted with each other. And I realized that people were doing, and you've heard this, I'm sure, 1,000 times, people are doing the very best they know how with the tools they have. I didn't realize that some had more tools than others, some had more awareness than others, some had more sensitivities than others. That was all new for me. I had traveled a lot in my life, starting as a kid, and I look back on all of that, and I realized that we were different from different cultures and whatnot because of the experiences that we were having and our traditions and whatnot, but I didn't realize that there was a core thing about vibratory frequency, that came much later, that changed all of that. You know, I've learned that people who are vibrating where I am or who are experiencing what I am, We don't have to have a big introductory thing. We're on the same page and we like know each other and we just go from there. So I'm very grateful for all of this experience and awareness.
There is talk of a shift coming in the human race. Do you get any sense of that? Or is that something that people talk about and you think, well, I don't know what that is. I don't see anything coming.
Well, I think we all see something coming because we cannot continue the way we are. There's such a divide in how people perceive what is happening in the world. And there's a group on the left and there's a group on the right and there are people in the middle and whatnot. You know, there's all kinds of stuff going on and there's so much hatred and there's no reason to have hatred. Why would we hate anybody because they believe something different than what we believe? Isn't there enough space and time for everything, for everyone? I believe there is. I don't think the universe made us or God made us or spirit made us to just be, you know, one way. I think that was kind of the thing that I got from the difference of how I felt as a kid before and after, you know, my near-death experience, is that, you know, we have two choices in life. We can be right or we can be happy. And I focus on being happy. I don't give a damn about being right. That doesn't do anything for anybody. I'm not living in ego anymore. I want to be happy. What do I need to do to make myself happy? So there has to be a place where people who are like me, who want to be happy, who want to be loving, who want to encourage the world to grow and, you know, be its best version. And then there are people who just want to control it. So I think it's going to be interesting. Are we going to have two worlds? Are some going to be on the inside of Earth and some going to be on the outside of Earth? It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, but I do believe it's coming. It can't not.
Let's hope it's all positive.
I'm always coming from that place. You know, I don't listen to the news, especially about politics anymore, because in my country, it's too devastating. And so I've decided to just focus on my world and what I can create, what I can bring to the party, meaning the world, and what I want for myself. I don't have the power to change what's gotten put into motion out there. That's beyond my capacity. I can, however, make a difference in my own world and make sure that I'm showing up the best version of myself and putting my best energies into the world. And I'm working on loving myself and upping my vibration every day. And that's my job. And it's my pleasure. And it's where I have power. I don't have power in the bigness of all that other stuff. So I'm choosing not to play in it. You know, I realized that I am creating my own TV show. You're creating your own, Simon. How do we want it to look? Ours may be very different, and that's okay because we're having different experiences as we're supposed to. I don't need to control yours. You don't need to control mine. We can coexist and be honoring and loving with that. I just think we haven't gotten to the awareness of that yet. I'm hoping I see it in my lifetime.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I've loved being here.
For the listeners, once more, could you give us your website address?
Certainly. It's guidingyourspirit.com.
And I'll put the link in the show notes. And thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Simon.
And that was an interview with Diane Sherman about her near-death experience. If you'd like to support the podcast, one of the best ways to do so is by joining me on Patreon. For just $6 a month, you'll get exclusive access to an extended episode every week. And if you prefer a smaller commitment, $3 a month gives you access to one extended episode each month. Plus, you can now try it out with a 7-day free trial. Patreon episodes are completely ad-free and available 2 days before the free versions. If you'd like to become a patron, just visit patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. You'll also find all the links in the show notes. And if you're enjoying the podcast, it would mean a lot if you could leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.